Hello, everyone, and welcome to what is something new on my podcast. And I'm introducing now a new interview series at the behest of the editors of Communio International Catholic Review, the North American edition, which is housed at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. I am a consulting editor for Communio and an author who has published in Communio. And as many of you know, I am a promoter of Communio theology. To that end, the editors reached out to me and said, hey, let's start a new series of interviews, since you do so many of them, where Communio comes out quarterly. So once every quarter, when the new issue comes out, I am to interview one of the authors of one of the articles. And they sent me the list this time, and I was thrilled when I saw the name of Father Uwe Michael Long, and he is our guest today. So welcome, Father Long. Before I give any more introductions, I want to welcome you and thank you for being on here today.
Thank you very much, Larry. Very happy to be part of this podcast.
Okay. We're going to be discussing Father Long's article in the upcoming issue of Communio, which has not been issued yet, as of this recording anyway. It's called Transforming the World into Communion with God, the Sacred Liturgy and the Thought of Joseph Ratzinger. And before we get to the article, I do want to give a brief biographical introduction to Father Long, to which he can add at the end. And I'll just read what I have here. Father Uwe Michael Long, a native of Nuremberg, Germany, is a priest of the Oratory of St. Philip Neri in London. He holds a doctorate in theology from the University of Oxford and teaches church history at Mater Ecclesiae College, St. Mary's University, Twickenham, and at Allen Hall Seminary, London. He is an associate staff member at the Maryvale Institute in Birmingham and on the visiting faculty of the Liturgical Institute in Mundelein, Illinois. Many of our viewers here and listeners know of the Liturgical Institute here in the United States. He is the editor of Antiphon, a journal for liturgical renewal. From 2008 to 2012, he was a staff member of Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments. And from 2008 to 2013, he was a consultant to the Office for the Liturgical Celebrations of the Supreme Pontiff. In the academic year 2011-2012, he taught as professore incaricato for History of Christian Worship and Hagiography at the Pontifical Institute for Christian Archaeology in Rome. He's the author of many books. His early research was in Christological controversies, especially the Council of Chalcedon and so forth. But his interests have since somewhat shifted, at least, towards liturgy. And he is also, I already mentioned that, editor of Antiphon. Anyway, is there anything that you would like to add to your extensive biography there, Father?
That is very extensive and quite comprehensive, so nothing to add. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Well, that establishes your bona fides for writing this. And quite frankly, I was thrilled to read this article because it combines two of my interests, which is the theology of Joseph Ratzinger and the importance of the liturgy. So to that end, what we're going to do here, folks, today is I'm just going to sort of walk through this article, sort of topic by topic, and have Father comment on it. And I might throw in a comment or two of my own, but I'll try not to be overly intrusive. That's not my role here. Let's begin as you begin with the article, which is why is according to Joseph Ratzinger, liturgy is extremely important to the theological science, to the theological discipline. It's also important with regard to our Gottesdienst, our service of worship towards God, and so on. It also embraces a full vision of human life and the cosmos and so on. So maybe you could comment on those first opening sort of pages there of your article where you talk about, for Joseph Ratzinger, the overall significance of liturgy.
The liturgy really is at the heart of Joseph Ratzinger's theology, at the heart of his thought. In one of his works, in his autobiographical work, Milestones, he says that the liturgy is the Lebensgrund of theology. So there's the soul or heart of theology is scripture, but the Lebensgrund is the liturgy. A word that is a bit difficult to translate. You could even translate it habitat or foundation for life. But certainly, liturgy is where theology, our reflection, about God, is kind of becomes alive and really shapes our Christian lives, the way we actually live our Christian faith. So liturgy is essentially about our relationship with God and with one another in the mystical body, which is the church. But it is, in the first place, about our relationship with God. And hence, for Joseph Ratzinger, it was so important, really, to begin with the liturgy. As he commented when reflecting on Vatican II, the council began with the document on the liturgy. Now, historians tell us there were other circumstances that actually led to that start with the liturgy, but Joseph Ratzinger saw something significant in that start with the liturgy. And really, in a way, it's a thread that goes through his theological work from the early days, 1950s, 1960s, well into his pontificate.
Yes. Do you think, and this isn't specifically addressed in your article, so I hope I'm not throwing you a curveball, but do you think that he felt that before the Second Vatican Council, that there had been a divorce between theology and liturgy, much as, say, von Balthasar pointed out, there had been a divorce between sanctity and theology? Had there been a divorce between liturgy and theology as well?
I think you can say that, yes. Liturgy as a more specific theological discipline was very much limited to, well, specialists, who commented on, well, the right way of celebrating the liturgy, rubricism. I know this is, I mean, this has its in place. I'm not saying that this is completely unimportant, but I think perhaps the theological vision of the liturgy was somewhat impoverished. Now, this changed certainly in the 20th century with the liturgical movement, above all. With that new beginning of liturgical scholarship, Josef Andreas Jungmann comes to mind.
Yes.
So there was a great rediscovery of the liturgy, also in relating it closer to theology.
Yes, thank you for that. For that, Claire. I had in mind maybe the sort of neo-scholastic hegemony that sort of existed during that time. But you're entirely correct. I mean, there was the whole liturgical movement and a great deal of theological speculation on liturgy going on. I'm going to move on to the next section, which deals with how Ratzinger anchors the liturgy. And I'm going to quote from the article where you said, "Looking back on his liturgical writings, Benedict XVI stated that his main interest always lay in, quote, anchoring the liturgy in the foundational act of our faith, and thus also about its place in the whole of human existence." Could you maybe elaborate on that just a bit?
But of course, as a theologian, as a cardinal, Joseph Ratzinger contributed to a lot of the discussions, also controversies about the liturgy, which we have had in the last few decades. But I thought in writing this article, it was important really to give a broader vision why the liturgy really was so important for him. And I think it, and again, it really... is about how we relate to God, and of course how God relates to us, and how we respond to God's revelation to us, and so hence the way we worship matters. I mean, there's this beautiful reflection Joseph Ratzinger has in the spirit of the liturgy on the Exodus narrative. So it's the Exodus narrative is ordered towards worship. The Israelites actually leave Egypt in order to worship their God as God wants them to worship him. And so in a way then the whole purpose of Christian existence is moving towards that adoration of God, which is the great vision of the Book of Revelation, of the Apocalypse.
Right.
And this is in some way anticipated, already made real in the liturgy of the church, which we are celebrating here and now, but which is never just about what we are doing here and now, but already a foreshadowing of that eschatological reality.
Very good. Yes. And you sort of anticipate, I say very good, because you anticipate what I was about to bring up, which is the role of the temple. Ratzinger, according to your article, delineates sort of three aspects to liturgy. There was the sort of relationship of the Old Testament to the New Testament, and we're going to talk about that. But then there's the relationship of the liturgy with sort of other religious rituals and other religions. And then there's a sort of cosmic dimension to the liturgy. So you've already hit upon the importance of the sort of transition from old to new covenant. But let's move on into that, because in your article, and I found this very interesting, you emphasized that for Ratzinger, the temple and the temple sacrifice was more important for our understanding of liturgy than, say, synagogue worship. So maybe we could begin there.
Well, historians in general now say that there was no formalized synagogue worship, at least in Palestinian synagogues at the time of Jesus. The place of worship was the temple. That was the one great place of worship for the people of Israel. Synagogues were places where the scriptures were studied. Obviously, that happened in the context of prayer. They were social centers, really, centers for the community, always in the context of prayer, but not in the sense of more formalized worship. That developed later and also outside Israel, outside, well, Judea, I should say. So when we look at the temple or synagogue, I think that's quite important to keep in mind. Now, Jesus had a complex relationship with the temple. He went to the temple, took part in the annual or in the festivities, the great religious observances. But he also criticized the temple. We had recently the Sunday Gospel, the cleansing of the temple.
Yes.
So he denounced the priesthood for their inadequacies, for their contamination of the sacred space. So it's a complex relationship. And he made this great prophecy recorded by the evangelist St. John about the destruction and the rebuilding of the temple, which, of course, didn't refer to the building in the first place, but to his own body, as Ratzinger reads it as a prophecy of the cross and resurrection, but is in some way related to the temple, because the temple was later destroyed about four decades after the crucifixion, and the sacrifices ceased. And in a way, they had ceased to be meaningful already because of the sacrifice of the cross. So in a way, the temple is always in the background to that. And as exegetes also tell us today, the cleansing of the temple is related to the institution of the Eucharist at the Last Supper, because Jesus did not simply abolish worship or abolish the external forms of worship, but instituted his new worship, which is above all the sacrifice of the Eucharist. So these symbolic actions, the cleansing of the temple, institution of the Eucharist, are closely related. And in this context, it's also important what Joseph Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, often said, that Jesus also instituted a priesthood of the new covenant precisely to make that sacrifice of the Eucharist present throughout all ages until he would come again in glory. And then the temple also is very much present in the book of the Apocalypse, that vision of heavenly worship, which is presented in terms of temple worship. The letter to the Hebrews really makes a lot of the temple and how the new worship Jesus instituted really sort of replaces the temple worship. So, of course, there are significant differences. There is an element of discontinuity. The very sort of concrete sacrifices, animal sacrifices of the temple, were replaced by a spiritual sacrifice, a very much a spiritualized action, which we have in the liturgy of the Mass. But in order to understand it, the temple, the imagery of the temple is very important.
Thank you for that. I thought that was a really beautiful part of your article, and I found it fascinating precisely because at age 65 and having grown up in the post-conciliar church, one of the things that was often that you learned theologically as a young person, at least here in the United States, was, you know, that Jesus abolished the whole notion of a cultic priesthood, that he broke down the barriers between the sacred and the quotidian, which then justified a concept of the mass as just this fellowship meal and everybody gathered around the altar. So it was, I was really fascinated by that aspect of your article where Ratzinger wants to emphasize this notion that Jesus instituted a cultic priesthood and did not abolish the sort of distinction between the sacred and the profane. But maybe you could comment on that just a little bit more. You say in the article that Christ did not break down the barrier, according to Ratzinger, between the sacred and the quotidian and so forth. But in some sense, some barriers were broken down. I mean, the veil of the temple was torn in two. The distinction between Gentile and Jew is thereby abolished and so forth. There, you pointed out there were discontinuities and not just continuities with the old temple worship. So maybe you could elaborate just a little bit further on this relationship of the sacred and the profane in Ratzinger's thought.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. The veil of the temple was torn into two pieces, and that's often seen as a sign that precisely that distinction between the sacred and the profane is overcome. I mean, there's a certain way of thinking which goes back to pre-conciliar theology in the 1950s. In fact, Louis Bouyer takes issue with it. A certain way of thinking that claims with the incarnation, all these distinctions have been overcome. The whole world has been, as it were, sanctified by the presence of Christ. Well, but I think we have to introduce some distinctions here. It is true that this radical chasm between sacred and profane is overcome in the person of Jesus Christ, but it's a dynamic that hasn't been completed yet. The whole world has not yet been transformed into the worship of God, which is, well, brutally obvious if we look at our world. Yes, a new reality has entered into our world with the incarnation, that presence of God in the person of Jesus Christ, and in the way all of humanity already mystically participates in that, but this is not has not yet been completed. So the empirical conditions of our life still are relevant. So time and space, we live in sort of structured space and structured time, and so one argument would be it's a kind of pedagogy that we still need sacred time, we still need sacred space, because to speak in the words of the Book of Revelation, we're not living in the heavenly, not yet living in the heavenly city where God Himself and the Lamb are the temple.
Yes, we live in the metaxis. We live in the in-between. And you mentioned in your article about we're sort of still in that twilight where it's a mingling of the darkness and dawn and light that we're still longing for. I like that very much, that image that you had in your article. Let's move on then, because the next part deals. Well, no, before we get onto that, I want you to comment briefly on the relationship between the liturgy and other religions. You know, you mentioned in your article that for Ratzinger, this is not a huge topic, but I think it's important that we at least touch upon that. Does Ratzinger think there's any analogical points of overlapping context here between the Christian liturgy and other rites around the world and other religions?
He certainly thinks that there are some overlapping areas here. It doesn't, as far as I can see at least, it doesn't take a great deal of space in his overall work, but he reflects on sort of general aspirations you find in humanity. He speaks of the awareness of a fall and estrangement from God, from the cosmos, a struggle for forgiveness, for reconciliation, which is present in many religious traditions, and even in an early contribution speaks of pre-Christian sacramental forms, office of kings and priests, some form of mediation between the divine and human. So he does reflect about such general, I suppose, anthropological phenomena. Also, when he speaks about the character of a feast, what makes a feast as an Christian feast, he refers to the general sort of anthropology of a feast and says we need to see that as the root also for Christian feasts, which of course then have a specific Christian character, for example Easter, but also to be understood in a more general human context. It's more profitable to look at the way Joseph Ratzinger thinks about the cosmic dimension of the liturgy.
So that's the third dimension,
That's sort of embedded in a cosmic understanding. And there you also have motives then that relate to other religions as well. So he says cosmic elements are also integrated into the, well, he calls the historical liturgy of Christianity. That's where sort of facing east, the orientation in liturgical prayer has an important place for him, and also in general an understanding of sacred time and sacred space.
Yes, and of course he engages then in an exegesis of Genesis and the creation narrative, 6 days followed by Sabbath rest. Maybe you could comment on that a little bit.
That's also something he really sees at the heart of understanding of the liturgy. The covenant is really oriented towards the worship of God, and our response to God's gift of Himself is our worship. So, and the Sabbath becomes the place of encounter between God and His creature. Again, he in a way continues that in his reading of the Exodus narrative.
Yeah, and that brings us to what I think is really, in just this is me speaking personally, I don't want to extrapolate to everyone, what I thought was the most fascinating part of the article, where you begin to expound upon Ratzinger's exegesis of Romans 12:1, and Paul's phrase, which is usually translated, you know, that we need to, you know, consecrate our bodies to, you know, to Christ, because do you not that we are engaged in spiritual worship, which in Greek is logike latria, and it's usually translated as spiritual worship. And you know, Paul says, I appeal to you, therefore, my brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your translation, spiritual worship, logike latria. But Ratzinger doesn't necessarily reject the notion that we're talking here about spiritual worship, but he deepens this concept, and then he moves on to an analysis of this same concept in St. Augustine. So I would really be interested in you expounding a little bit on this topic, because I think it's fascinating.
It is a central concept in Ratzinger's theology of the liturgy, but also in his theology in a wider sense. He refers to that idea of logike latreia in his Regensburg speech, for instance. And for him, it's worship according to the logos. So he zooms in the logos that is contained in the adjective logike. So it is sort of, it can mean spiritual or interior worship, but it can also mean sort of rational worship. Rational as, and for example, in the Roman canon of the Mass, as opposed to blood sacrifice. So it's a rational worship, a worship that rational beings owe to God. But it's more than that. It's also the divine logos that is present there. So it's really the word, the eternal word. Who then becomes human, who becomes incarnate, and so Ratzinger goes back actually to The Old Testament critique of sacrifice. So, Psalm 50 or 51, for you take no delight in sacrifice, the sacrifice acceptable to God is a broken spirit. And then you had sort of that fascinating mixture of Greek and Jewish ideas, and someone like Philo of Alexandria, where you get this idea of a mystical union with the Logos, the eternal word, sort of the essential meaning or structure of the universe. And so you have the idea of sacrifice in the word of prayer. So quite a spiritualized idea, and the word of prayer in our inner disposition, in the contrite heart, in the heart that turns to God. But as Augustine already comments in the same psalm, Psalm 50, 51, where it is said that God does not desire sacrifice, then in the end we say, well, once Jerusalem is taught, we will offer you the right sacrifice. So God does desire sacrifice after all. Which is it? Well, it's the one that becomes real in the incarnate word, who becomes flesh, becomes human, and offers himself off on the cross. And that's the kind of sacrifice according to the Logos. The worship, actually, as Ratzinger called it in the, or Benedict XVI, I should say, called it in the Regensburg speech, worship in harmony with the eternal word and with our reason. And then that leads him to a reflection on the Eucharist. And there he's very much rooted in Augustine, the 10th book of the City of God,
yes.
Which was very important to him. This, for him, this really was the most profound theology of worship and also of the Eucharistic sacrifice. I wrote an article about this part of the City of God, partly because I found it so difficult to understand. I was teaching a course on St. Augustine, and we were reading the 10th book of the City of God, and I was really quite perplexed by it. And so I got deeper into it and tried to understand it better, and that's where the article came out in the end. And it's a very profound, very Augustinian understanding of that sacrifice of Christ, sacrifice of his self, which then is made present in the sacrifice of the church, and where basically the whole church offers herself together with her head, with the high priest, and that is made sort of real and also made anew every day in Mass, Holy Mass.
Yeah, here's a great quote from your article, which I really loved. You write, in the context of his critique of polytheistic sacrificial worship, Augustine offers a discussion of true sacrifice, which he defines as every work done in order that we might cling to God in holy fellowship. That is, every work which is referred to the final good in which we can be truly blessed. And then that's end quote from Augustine. You say, note in the first place Augustine's theocentric conception of sacrifice. Not every good work for a fellow human being is a sacrifice, but only such that is done for God's sake. I thought that was fascinating.
I find it a very profound theology of sacrifice, really. There has been quite a bit of debate about what the nature of a sacrifice is. There's a kind of oblationist school which follows the tracks of Saint Augustine. There's the immolationist school, which also has its place. But certainly, I think there's a very this is a very profound understanding which Augustine presents here and Ratzinger takes up and develops.
And that the concept of consecration comes in here as well, where consecration implies the transferring of ownership of something to God. You know, that this is an essential element of our sacrifice as well. And that this, you know, the sacrifice is holy and pleasing, which is the love transformed humankind in true worship for Ratzinger. So then you go on to discuss then the relationship between liturgy and the notion of the church as communion. So a kind of Ratzinger's communio theology, and therefore the church is a relation of persons and so on, both horizontally and vertically. So maybe you could expound on that just a little bit, because I think that's a critical dimension here.
Ratzinger was one of the great exponents of communio theology, communio ecclesiology, really rooting our understanding of the church in that communion. And for him, that was very profoundly grounded in the Eucharist. It's the sacrament of the Eucharist that makes us into one body, in a sense that the unity of the church is made by the Eucharist. Hence also the last encyclical of Saint John Paul II, Ecclesia de Eucharistia, the church from the Eucharist, where I believe Cardinal Ratzinger then had quite a lot of the impact on that particular encyclical. And so for him, this is really something very, very important, also in the sense of the universal church, really. I think Ratzinger's distinctive idea of a communio ecclesiology is the priority of the universal church over the local church. It's quite a debate he had with Cardinal Kasper at the time.
Yes.
And his emphasis on the universal nature of the liturgy is something that we cannot create, which we do not possess, but which is actually in which we something which we share, and where we sort of accede to, is related to his emphasis on the priority of the universal church.
Yes, that the liturgy is therefore something that we receive, and so that moves then now into the concrete dimensions of the liturgical reform as we saw it in the world. One of the things that really caught my eye in your article was where you pointed out that for Ratzinger, creativity is not a liturgical category.
Yes. Yes. He was quite strong on that, actually. He essentially says it's a Marxist conception that stands behind that idea. And it wants to really see the church in institutional terms, of sociological institutional terms, and distinguish from it the sort of local, autonomous, spontaneous community that is then empowered to create create its own liturgy. It's quite a fascinating analysis. And he does concede thus that there are areas in the liturgy that
a homily and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. But in a limited way. And he emphasizes the element of receptivity. We participate in something that is greater than we are. And he says this is also the liberating thing. And this is something that we don't need to make and construct, but it's given to us, and we can actually receive it, and to receive it joyfully. That's an important aspect of this
joyful receptivity. Yes, you quote that in there. I also, you've already mentioned this, but I want to come back to it, that Ratzinger is critical of, in some ways, the manner in which the liturgical calendar and the feast days were just sort of willy-nilly reorganized according to somebody's idea that they had in their head. But he says, mm-hmm. you know, in essence, what Ratzinger is saying is, you know, these kind of feasts they're not ersatz. They're not simply created out of thin air. They bubble up from below. This is kind of the populist Ratzinger in some mm-hmm. sense, right? So
yes.
Maybe let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the sanctoral calendar, if you actually look at some older missals, late 19th century, early 20th century, to some extent, feasts were always shifted around a bit, and new feasts were introduced. Other feasts had to make room. For example, we have Saint Perpetua and Saint Felicity. From very early on, 4th century, they were actually on the 7th of March. Then the feast of St. Thomas of Aquinas came, placed on the 7th of March, the day of his death. So St. Perpetua and Felicity were moved to the 6th. Now they've been moved back to the 7th. So a little bit of that has been going on always. But there was a lot of moving of this kind done with the new sanctuaral calendar, especially in 1969, 1970. And in a bit of a kind of technical spirit, I suppose, and those who drew up the calendar did not quite realize to what extent these feasts were rooted in In a particular people, you had feasts, you had particular traditions, customs that grew around these feasts, and you can't just sort of uproot them and plant them somewhere else. I mean, there may be good reasons why you would want to move the feast of Saint Thomas the Apostle on the 21st of December to another day, but at the same time, in Central Europe, in Austria, in many places, you had a special market day, the St. Thomas market, and that sort of thing. And again, you just uproot these customs and traditions, and then it you that has a detrimental effect on how people live their faith.
Yeah, I mean, just to be autobiographic, I remember when I was a young boy in the 1960s, of my parents' generation here in the United States, there was a strong devotion to Saint Christopher, for the patron saint of travelers. Everybody had a Saint Christopher statue or medal in there, hanging in their car. They'd carry it in their wallet on an airplane. And then all of a sudden, after the council, I was told anyway, well, Saint Christopher's gone. He's out. So we can't do that anymore. So yeah, that's just these are just I think little small examples of what Ratzinger is talking about. I want to move on. Something else that really fascinates, I keep saying this. Oh, this fascinated me. The whole thing was fascinating. I really encourage people when this comes out to really pour into this article because it's just fantastic. One of the things that really struck me, because I'm a huge fan of Romano Guardini, but like you point out in the article, Ratzinger gravitated towards Guardini, obviously, for the same reason I did, because, and I think a lot of people, because of Guardini's analysis of modernity and of his real prescient prophetic understanding of how God has been eclipsed in the modern world, this rupture between God and world, and so on. But Guardini also wrote a lot about liturgy, and I am not as familiar with Guardini's writings on liturgy as I was with his other writings. So I was fascinated when you pointed out in the article that Ratzinger actually had some differences with Guardini with regard to liturgical reform. So maybe you could elaborate on that just a bit, because I think it's interesting.
I find certain aspects of Guardini's work rather difficult. And I was always wondering what exactly drew Pope Benedict to Guardini. And I missed one chance to ask him. Actually, it was a privilege to be able to visit him after he had renounced the papacy. And that would have been the opportunity to ask him, but I didn't. So I missed that opportunity, but I think now, having read several contributions on this topic, I think what Benedict mainly appreciated about Guardini was precisely that analysis of modernity, the separation of faith and reason, and also Guardini's idea that the liturgy could actually bridge that. Also the emphasis on the priority of logos over ethos,
Yes.
you find in Guardini, so a priority of I suppose the well logos the rational not just the rational but I guess the how would you translate? Yeah, I suppose the rational over the moral, over action, or thought over action. Maybe that's the
Yeah.
best way of thinking of translating it. Priority of thought over action, or ideas over action. But when it comes to liturgy, it seems to be that really Ratzinger is actually quite critical of Guardini. He makes reference to him and pays homage to him at the beginning of his book on the spirit of the liturgy, but then really takes a very different direction. There's in Guardini, there's this emphasis on liturgy as play, and
Spiel,
Ratzinger's
Spiel, yeah.
Spiel, yeah, the Spiel. And he says, Ratzinger goes on to say, actually, this is not very adequate because it's not play, but rather adoration, Anbetung.
Anbetung.
Yeah. So that's why I think it's more Guardini's general philosophical vision, his analysis of modernity, where Ratzinger is indebted to him rather than specific liturgical thought.
Yes, and that really struck me because I had never realized before the extent to which Guardini, because I went back and looked, Guardini emphasized this notion of Spiel, which I can see why that would be problematic for Ratzinger. Ratzinger also would, in terms of the liturgical renewal, I mean, it's interesting. You point out in the article that Ratzinger was totally in favor of the idea that the old mass needed to be reformed in some way, that it needed simplification, for starters, and maybe a limited use of the vernacular, but that he was not really all that happy or pleased with what we eventually did get, which he thought was kind of too minimalist, primitivist, engaged in a kind of archaism, that sort of thing. So is that an accurate assessment of Ratzinger's view of what we got in the liturgical renewal?
I would agree, yes. I mean, he was essentially supportive of the liturgical reform. He said that again and again in the 1960s, 1970s at later, but he also saw certain aspects of it critically. You mentioned already the question of the calendar, the desacralization that went along with the introduction of the new liturgical books. So he would have quite a lot of critical points to make while essentially being supportive of it.
Yes, and he was obviously a big advocate as well of worship ad orientem. He really was critical of the notion that the priest has to face the people, which in some ways he views as kind of a clericalistic stance, you know, that where the priest faces with the people eschatologically towards the east, then that's kind of less clericalistic. Along those lines, then, I don't want to go necessarily into all the. I personally attend an Anglican ordinariate parish, so you know, I appreciate ad orientem worship, altar rails, communion on the tongue while kneeling, you know, bells and smells and chants. So, these are all the things that sort of Ratzinger was pointing at in the need for a renewal of the liturgical rites of the church. And along those lines, you mention in your article, and we have about 10 minutes left here, that Ratzinger believed that we needed a relecture, a relecturing, if you will, of Sacrosanctum Concilium. He pointed out there were a couple of elements in Sacrosanctum. There were the fundamental principles, which he thinks were sound. And then Sacrosanctum gave us some practical suggestions, which he doesn't necessarily think are all that pertinent for today's world. And then, of course, there was the third phase, which was the post-conciliar renewal, which he also thinks are not necessarily grounded in the principles of Sacrosanctum Concilium. Therefore, he wants us to do a kind of rereading of Sacrosanctum in the light of our current circumstances. So maybe you could comment on that relecture.
I think one of the difficulties we have experienced in interpreting Vatican II documents is the absence of anathemas. I mean, they decided not to have anathemas to give them an open, so friendly face to the world. But these anathemas, which were used from Nicaea to Vatican I, are actually in one sense quite useful because they have a lengthy doctrinal or otherwise exposition. And then you get sort of the essential points in the anathemas, and they don't clarify everything. If you look at the Council of Trent, it doesn't clarify everything, never intended to clarify everything. But you have a kind of posts being hammered in to delineate what the space that where you can hold various positions and still be Catholic, and outside, well, your position is no longer Catholic. And that's a bit lacking in Vatican II documents. So you have these long documents, and then you get the whole battle over interpretation. And Ratzinger distinguishes between these different levels, the general principles, which are obviously command the highest authority, and we need to return to those. That's also what Pope Francis says in Desiderio Desideravi, return to the general principles. And then you have a lot of instructions which are just more of its time, of their own time. And these can be reviewed and should be reviewed. And Ratzinger uses that concept from Francophone biblical scholarship, which argues that within the canon of scripture, certain texts have been reread and reinterpreted within salvation history. So you have the famous prophecy from Isaiah 7:14, behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, which has a certain historical context, and you know, it's useful to know that, but already by the time of the Gospels, was read in a different way, was read in a messianic way, and is given in such a way by the evangelist. And so within the canon, you have this rereading. And so he says, we can also reread and need to reread the conciliar documents in our present context, with our experience of the last few decades.
Yeah, and this is absolutely, as you point out in the article, the pedagogy of Scripture, which rereads things from older elements of the Scriptures in the light of the later. It's kind of a canonical reading of the bits and pieces of salvation history, and we need to do something similar, according to Ratzinger, according to the liturgy. To that end, let's move on to some moves he made while Pope. Obviously, I've already mentioned one. I attend an Anglican ordinariate parish, so Ratzinger really opened the doors to this new development, liturgical development within the church, and I thank him for it. It's stunningly beautiful liturgy. But also, of course, there was Summorum Pontificum, where he allowed for a greater use of the Tridentine liturgy. And you mentioned in the article that you think that Ratzinger's hope was that there would be a kind of osmosis, that there would be this fertilization between the two rites by osmosis. So go ahead and elaborate a bit on that, especially in light of Traditionis Custodes and our current situation.
As Pope, Benedict was quite reticent to legislate. He had this idea that, I guess, the Pope should limit himself in his function as a lawgiver. And so, for example, he didn't produce any new editio typica of a liturgical book. He made very small changes, really very quite insignificant changes to the actual rites, because he thought this somehow had to grow organically as a movement, a new liturgical movement, as he called it. And he was convinced that genuine liturgical renewal isn't produced by instructions or documents. And he was certainly, I think he was absolutely right about this. But on the other hand, the way of the Latin Church has very much been that of the law, as great Roman heritage, and the Pope is the supreme lawgiver, and so it may have been desirable to enshrine some of these ideas, impulses, into the law of the Church, as done with the ordinariate use, the divine worship use, as it's called. And I was actually collaborating in that when I was a staff member of the Congregation for Divine Worship. But in the sense of the Summorum Pontificum was Pope Benedict's most significant step in that direction. And it was actually quite a very important step. People really often don't remember very well. It's the short-term memory that, I guess, dominates our life. Everything happens so fast. But if you remember the years before Summorum Pontificum, there was quite a battle. And it wasn't easy for Pope Benedict to pass Summorum, or to bring out Summorum Pontificum. And it was quite courageous at the time. Many, including bishops, cardinals, who actually were very supportive of him, were rather reticent about that particular step. So he, he went out on a limb for that. But I think he was hoping that it would really bring about that sort of rereading of Sacrosanctum Concilium, initiate that rereading of Sacrosanctum Concilium, and would also have an impact on, the ordinary form of the Roman Rite of Mass. Now, as we have seen with Traditionis Custodes, an act of legislation can also be repealed. So I guess in the end, Pope Benedict was very right that you can't have an authentic liturgical renewal with legislation and instructions. But I think you need to support it in that way if you want it, because that's the way, well, the church operates.
Yes, I think that when one can see the wisdom, perhaps. I mean, I was count me among one of those people that thought, well, liturgy is this festering issue in the church. If we ever needed legislation from Rome on anything, it's to resolve some of these liturgical disputes. And I was very disappointed, actually, when Pope Benedict did not legislate certain things to come into the Novus Ordo. That I think would have been salutary, but in retrospect, you're right. Now, looking at Traditionis Custodes, as you note in the article, one legislative act can be rolled back by another one. So, but what Pope Benedict did was he actually planted some seeds in the church, and really created these little sub-communities of devotion to the old rite that still persist. I mean, Traditionis Custodes did meet with some resistance, right, and still does, and that resistance has sometimes taken, I think, an inappropriate approach. But still, nevertheless, those seeds are there.
Yes, and yes, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Yes, and certainly, I mean, I'm sure there have been problems. There are always problems in the life of the church. I mean, issues that need to be addressed. But in general, I thought it worked rather well, and it did establish Summorum Pontificum, and it did establish a coexistence, peaceful and also fruitful coexistence of the two forms. So and in a sense now the old wounds have been reopened, and I completely agree that some of the responses were really have been inappropriate and are not helpful for the course of the liturgy. But the difficulties remain.
Yes. Well, let's. I'd like I'd, before we wrap this up, I would be remiss if we didn't address, I think, an important issue, which is for Ratzinger, especially the spirit of the liturgy. You mentioned that one of the guiding motifs was his attempt to fully understand the council's desire for the faithful to have an active participation in the liturgy. That phrase has been much bandied about. And for example, you mentioned in your article, Karl Rahner and Herbert Vorgrimler point out that active participation means that we can't have very high artistic music in the liturgy, because that means then the faithful can't participate in it, which to me would imply that what they were arguing for was a more populist, almost vulgar concept of simple music that people can tap their feet to and sing. So Ratzinger is often accused in his development of active participation of being a kind of elitist. So maybe you could delve into both those kind what Ratzinger meant by active participation and his defense of his vision of music and art in the liturgy.
Yes, you say a lot of ink has been spilled on the idea of active participation. Some authors, Father Aidan Nichols, have tried to reinterpret it as actual participation. But I think actuosa pretty much means active if you look at the origin of the term. The principle has been interpreted in a very superficial way as a kind of activism. Doing things, Ratzinger wanted to go deeper, as you usually did, and really ground our kind of ritual participation in an interior participation. The first and important most important aspect of participation is participating in the prayer of the church. You must be aware that you actually join the prayer of the church, and then also the offering of Christ's sacrifice. There are moments in the liturgy when, of course, some participation, some response is called for, especially in the liturgy of the word. But then certainly when it comes to the prayer par excellence, the Eucharistic prayer, it's that act, attitude of receptivity, really, that is the most appropriate, and that joining in the prayer of the church. And also with regarding music, the very idea that that you can't sort of join in mentally, spiritually, with music unless you sing it yourself is rather, I mean, it's rather philistine, really, rather yeah. bizarre. But I mean, it had a certain traction, that theory. Yeah. But I think, I would always argue that you can really fully consciously participate in listening to Gregorian chant and great sacred music, and you don't need to be an expert in music to be able to do that. A basic sense of beauty, basic aesthetic sense, which we believe all people have, and can open their hearts and minds to that music.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the Anglican ordinary parish I attend has a trained choir, and I can't sing at all, and certainly the congregation doesn't want to hear me sing. And I sit and I actively participate in listening to our choir sing beautiful chants, beautiful hymns, beautiful anthems, introits, and so on. And to say that I'm not participating simply because I'm not vocalizing the words, I think, is a great diminishment of our understanding. I remember when I did my doctoral work on Hans Urs von Balthasar, and I remember he said very similar things about active participation, that, you know, because he was also a big believer in the notion of receptivity and contemplation as our fundamental stance before God. Hence why I guess he and Ratzinger were such good friends.
Yes.
In so many ways. Well, thank you so much, Father, for coming on today. You're a pioneer today, as am I. Hopefully this wasn't, I wasn't too nervous and awkward today. I was a bit, because this was the first in a series of these communio interviews. But I thought it went smashingly well, to use a British phrase. It was smashing. All right. And because you're in London. But I thought it was great. And so thank you so much for being on today.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be part of that first podcast. Glad you told me, because I wouldn't have guessed. I thought you'd have done that many, many times.
Well, I've done podcasts before, but never for communio. So I was a bit nervous. But anyway, thank you so much for coming on today. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Good. Bye. Thank now. You very much. It's been delightful.